Sleep. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. My guests today are all seekers, if you will. Their drives have led them to some important discoveries about themselves, and in turn they've shared their knowledge and gifts with others. On today's show, we'll hear from a writer, some artists, and a chaplain as we continue our discussion about the art and science of caring, from the smallest to the largest acts. There's been a lot of caring this week in the wake of the mass murder in a Connecticut elementary school. Since then, several people suggested I write something for our listeners. Well, at first, I thought I'd talk about how you could explain this to your children, you know, the standard psychologist bullet points. But all of that seemed artificial in the wake of this devastation. The mother of a 4-year-old boy told me she cried all day Friday. I said in response that the whole country seemed to be crying. Our hearts are broken. Sure, our minds get active with a million thoughts about what happened. But the great pain is because our hearts are broken. So what can we do about broken hearts? Love deeply and gently what is in great pain. Hold your broken heart tenderly. You really don't have to do anything. Just feel and allow your heart to cry about this reality of all of our lives. Love what is most vulnerable. Your children, those children, all children. And hold these tender hearts gently with deep love and painful knowledge that all of your love cannot make them less vulnerable. As your heart heals, and it will, there'll be scar tissue where the wound was. That scar tissue is a reminder to love what's most vulnerable. Please go to our website at whyy.org/voices. I've posted one of my favorite poems there about healing our hearts and the world. It's by my dear friend Ellen Bass. This is Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about caring today, and we've got lots of guests, including a singer, a composer, a filmmaker, and a chaplain who've all led by example in the name of caring about others. My first guest has written about what it means to be good. His latest book is called Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good. Mark Matuszek joins us by phone. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to be here, and that was such a beautiful piece.
Thank you. That was not my mouth speaking. That was my heart speaking.
Yes.
We're taking calls today, and we'd love to hear from you about what caring really means, what happens when caring truly turns into action. Our number is 888-477-9499. Mark, I want to start, with the title of your book. I don't think I've ever seen the words ethical and wisdom next to each other.
It's funny that you would say that. And there's such an obvious combination, really. We tend to think of wisdom as something sort of above general human interactions, as something that's other or sacred, belonging in its own sphere, and ethics as something that's worldly and all about justice and fairness. But truly, they are deeply linked because they're both about how we weigh the two sides of our nature to come to a third position, which I think of as the sacred position, which encompasses both. I mean, when you start to look at human nature deeply, and when you go into the brain science, you realize it's all paradox, that while we are wired to be good, We also do have this tendency toward selfishness and delusion and ignorance and all of those other emotions. So how do we deal with the paradox of being both intrinsically cooperative and good and kind, and also prone to making mistakes? So that's why I wanted to look at how we could see wisdom as an ethical issue, and bring wisdom into our moral and ethical choices.
So how would you envision that playing out, say, in the wake of Friday's tragedy? How does goodness look, act, in the way of Friday's tragedy?
Well, what you said about speaking from the heart and going to the possibility that comes out of any tragedy, the possibility that comes out of something like the Newtown shootings, is an increase in awareness and compassion and caring. The beautiful side of harm and bad things happening is the way people come together afterward to support each other and to resolve to change the way we behave toward one another. And that, unfortunately, is how we grow. We grow through mistakes and pain and suffering. Suffering is what wakes us up. So while none of us wants anything like that, you know, like this horror to happen, when it does happen, it's our responsibility and opportunity to grow from it and to increase wisdom around the causes that made it occur.
So let me push a little bit further here, Mark. So what does that look like? Say I'm sitting in my living room now listening to the show. How do we translate that? How do you translate that for me? I want to do something differently in the wake of that. I'm deeply moved.
Mm-hmm. The first thing you can do is exercise, is talk, if you're a parent, talk to your children about violence and make moves to make your children aware of the of how important it is to care for one another and help them understand where violence comes from. And so many kids today are inured to violence through TV and you know, video games and that kind of thing. So I think it's to start to look at our kids, what we teach our children and what we don't teach our children. And rather than shielding kids from pain and ugliness and suffering, I think it's important for them to know the possibility of suffering, to grow a more compassionate heart. I mean, you are trying to. We teach our kids learn empathy and compassion by witnessing our empathy and compassion. So by sharing our own pain with them, in appropriate ways, it makes them more caring people.
I want to make sure we squeeze in a question about you. Your bio is really, I mean, it makes for interesting reading. So let me just do the quick summary. So after graduating from Berkeley, you go to Oxford and finish things up with a graduate degree in English literature. Then you go from Newsweek magazine's letter department to Andy Warhol's interview magazine to becoming what you call an itinerant Dharma bum.
Yes. I
mean, that's not your standard journey.
No, it's not. But I have to say that tragedy really woke me up and gave me my real work and my real life. I was a freelance. I was an editor at working for Andy Warhol in New York when the AIDS epidemic hit in the early 80s. My boss died. My best friend from college died. And for me, it was a great wake-up call to what do I care about in life. If I were going to not be here in a couple of years, what would mean something to me? So I left my job, I left New York, and I went on a spiritual pilgrimage, really, that lasted about 10 years. I really was a Dharma bum living all around the world. I wanted to know what life meant, if there was something, if God really existed, and what my inner life was all about. I had spent so much time climbing in the world and trying to be a success that I had really ignored any sort of inner development. And what that did is gave me my work as an author, and it completely changed the way I saw the world. Rather than seeing the world as a competitive dog eat dog, sort of circus of brutality, I saw the world through a more Buddhist perspective. I started practicing Buddhism during that time, 25 years ago. And the first premise of Buddhism is that human nature is innately good, and that we behave in bad ways because of ignorance or delusion or greed, but that doesn't change our fundamental nature. And that's a real turnaround, a real slap in the face to what many of us are taught about original sin and being fallen beings. So for me, it was enormously hopeful and helpful to take in the Buddhist idea of altruism and goodness and the possibility of enlightenment.
It takes some work to say people are basically good, and making that leap to seeing the goodness in people. I mean, I give talks, we see bumper stickers, smell the roses, people nod on shows like this, and it doesn't change anybody, really. And I'm hearing more and more people sign emails, namaste, which means I acknowledge the holiness in you, but do they really? I mean, do they see it and experience it? So there's a lot of steps between believing it and feeling it inside.
That's true, but every journey starts with a single step, and it's the decision to look for the good, to see the good, to find one good thing, as they say in Buddhism, about even your worst enemy, is the beginning of changing the way you see the world. And it's so easy to fall into skepticism and cynicism and jadedness, and to believe what you read in the paper. But the truth is that for every act of malice, there are innumerable acts of help and love and positive, positive exchange that we never hear about.
So
if we were not overwhelmingly cooperative and good creatures, we would not have survived. We simply would not be where we are today.
So here I am trying to push you around and bring up how difficult it is, and phrases don't change people, and no matter what I say, you find the goodness and the optimism. You Buddhists are a tough group to push around. Man.
But we are realists also. No, we truly are.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Rena on the line. Hi, Rena.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that there's definitely this whole tragedy in Connecticut really speaks to a larger societal problem where people don't feel that they can really be open with each other and cultivate honest, supportive relationships where they can share what's most deeply troubling them because of shame and embarrassment. And I hope that from one of the things from this tragedy that can really emerge is people trying to build these more warm, loving communities where people make the effort to find out, how is my neighbor really doing? Is there some way that I can help her or him? And that way, hopefully, certain problems can be prevented.
All right, Rena, I tried to push Mark around with no success. Let me try it with you. So I agree with everything you said just now. What's your plan?
What's my plan?
Mm-hmm. What are you going to what are you going to
well,
do?
Well, I can say in high school, actually, I was in high school during Columbine, and this was many years ago, but I developed this program called Virtues Week, and it basically a group of students we sold these awards or recognition papers, and we sold them to everybody in the school community, teachers, the janitors, the secretaries, the students, and it was a chance for you to recognize another student in the community for any action or value that they had that meant something to you, whether it was their kindness or generosity or something they did for you. And then we had an assembly, a public recognition ceremony, a week later, and it was in the same way that we recognize in schools, people for their athletic abilities and their academic abilities. We did the same thing for those really intrinsic values that at the end of the day is really what matters. And
so
we've raised a lot of, yeah.
Rena, so you've got a history of being an activist, and you have a blueprint. So do us all a favor, all of us in the community, all of us here in the studio with me, the people I referred to earlier as seekers, activists, do us all a favor and have a plan. Do something. You're the one. It's your kind of attitude. It's your kind of heart and spirit that are going to do something. So please make a plan. You got it in you. I appreciate the call, and I hope you're okay with me pushing you around just now. Thanks so much for your call. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll speak more with Mark Matuszek. He's the author of Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good. We're also going to be joined by Chaz Howard, a dear friend of mine. He's chaplain at University of Pennsylvania. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY delivers news you can trust, educational programs kids and parents depend on, and entertainment that keeps everyone smiling. Newsworks.org has you covered with smart, local news. Terry Gross and Marty Moscowane talk to, well, just about every newsmaker you can think of. Make your tax-deductible gift to WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about change and what we can do through caring hearts and how we can cultivate caring hearts to actually make some changes in our lives and in the larger world, as our engineer Al Banks just reminded me of Gandhi's famous quote that, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." My guests are Mark Matuszek. He's written Ethical Wisdom. He's going to stay with us for this segment of the show. I'm also joined by Chaz Howard, chaplain at University of Pennsylvania. He helped launch a program called Resolution 13 for people who want to make service-minded resolutions. So, Chaz, hi.
Oh, hi, my friend. It's good to see you again.
You too. Tell us about Resolution 13 and how it came to be.
Well, we're now in our third year of the campaign, and it's pretty simple. We're just challenging people to make service-minded, outwardly focused New Year's resolutions rather than the usual self-focused ones. So rather than just resolving to save a little bit more money or exercise more, as positive and as good as those resolutions may be, we're challenging people to get out there and make resolutions to care for others in an intentional way, and to resolve to put more good out there in the world. And earlier you asked a great question of how does goodness look and act? And I think we're challenging people to employ their goodness through New Year's resolutions.
So give us a couple examples.
Well, this year and last year we had some powerfully simple ones and some big picture ones. We had someone named SJP resolve to live simply, by going to donate things that she doesn't use anymore to Goodwill, and to not purchase things she doesn't need. And then there was someone from Philadelphia who said they resolved to hang out with that person in their office that everyone makes fun of.
Mm.
Another one was from a young person named Natalie, 26. Last year she said she resolves to grow her hair long enough to donate to Locks of Love. And these sort of simple resolutions, I think, really do make a big difference.
Do they? I wonder now. I know you and what you're about, and I also know you are not a researcher, per se. So I wonder about follow-up. Is there any way of knowing what happens?
It's a great question. It's a great question. I mean, I think there's a base trust that we put out there, hoping that people do follow up on the resolutions. We hear from people throughout the course of the year, and sometimes when people make these very tangible, practical one-point mm-hmm. resolutions, it's much more
likely.
Absolutely, much more likely.
Tell me about yours, and especially, I'm told you made one in the wake of the Connecticut tragedy.
Yeah, I coming home Friday, I take the subway. And looking around, everyone was grief-stricken, as if we all lived in Newtown. And I spoke to my wife on the phone, and when she was picking up our girls from our elementary school, which is like 200 miles from Newtown, she said every parent there had wet faces from crying. Mm. And so I was wondering, what can I do? I think that's a question a lot of us around the country have been asking. What can we as individuals do? We don't make policy. We're not necessarily wealthy to make a donation to cover funeral expenses. So I prayed about it, and I tried to listen, and I felt deeply impressed in my spirit to fast, which was an unusual thing for me. I fasting's been a part of my spiritual journey for most of my life, but it was a strange answer I felt in my spirit, and I felt that I wanted to fast for peace, and it's usually something I do very privately between me and God. But I thought that by sharing it, it was a way to help bring attention to gun violence and help have some hard conversations with the people around me, particularly my friends and family members who own guns, and to sort of challenge them to get rid of them in a safe way, and to pray intently for impactful policy in our country that will change the world.
Mark, is this what you call ethical wisdom, turning tragedy into positive action, the kind we're hearing from Chaz and what we heard about on his webpage, Resolution 13?
Absolutely, because you're transforming pain into awareness and care and compassion. And that's the best you can possibly do, you know, with suffering, is to find the energy of grief, use the energy of grief, which is an energy. It comes, you know, grief and gravitas all come from the same. It's an energy that can be shifted into action, and it doesn't mean anything without action. I work with an organization called V-Day, which is about ending violence against women and girls, and we have, I'm the head of V-Men, and what we do is go into high schools and counsel young boys on violence and have them tell their stories about what they believe about masculinity, what they believe about strength, and what it means to be a man in the world. And we have extremely moving responses from these kids when they start to talk about how hard it is to be a man and how hard it is to balance the idea of being strong with being kind. And so that's really important work, and that's work that we're going to be doing more of in the wake of the Newtown tragedy.
I'll tell you, let me just throw one thing out about these kids' reactions. If you want to engage in an act of kindness, go up to someone and just ask them to tell you their story of mm-hmm. who they are, of their lives. It's simple and it's very powerful. Let's go to the phones. We've got Shannon on the line.
Yes, you asked the question, how are we changed by personal tragedy and can we grow from it? Many years ago, we had a son die of sudden infant death, and one of the hardest things, of course, that parents can face. And we realized that although he had only been with us a matter of weeks, our love was so strong, and that meant family love was so strong, that we should from then on let anyone in our family who wanted to be in it be there as long as they wanted. And that led to us sponsoring a Vietnamese family after the Vietnam War. A mom and dad and five kids moved in our house with us. sponsoring 5 different Rotary Exchange students so they could have a home for a year of high school here, sponsoring Lost Boys of Sudan so that they could learn to adjust to America. And it changed our lives entirely just by saying, you may be in our family for however long you'd like.
How has it changed your lives, Shannon? How has it changed who you are, how you see yourself in the world?
Would you say that again? I can barely hear you.
Yeah, how has it changed your life? More important, how has it changed how you see yourself?
We see ourselves as members of the rest of humanity, including around the world. And it meant that we raised our children with the feeling that they are citizens of the world and responsible for the tragedies that other people face around the world and for doing something about it. So it's changed entirely who we are. And I don't believe that God smites us in order to make us learn. I just am thankful that when we have tragedy, we can learn and grow from it.
Yeah, well, bless your heart for making the world a better place. I am grateful that you listened to the show, and I'm grateful that you called in today. Shannon, thank you so much. So this is the work you do, Chaz, at the University of Pennsylvania also. You do it one-on-one, face-to-face.
It's a challenge, I think, for all of us in a lot of ways. But over at Penn, we work with great kids, amazing students, and great faculty and staff, and have a lot of bright days, yet reality is tragedy and sadness hits all of us. And I loved what Mark was saying about the challenge to transform grief into a positive energy. It's a wonderful call that I think really does transcend almost all of our religious traditions and everyone.
There's a wonderful Buddhist story that I'm sure Mark knows already about a man who's had terrible suffering, and he goes to, I forget what it was, and he goes to his great teacher, and the teacher says, take a tablespoon of coarse salt and put it in a glass of water and drink it down. And of course, it tastes terrible. So he says, now take that same tablespoon of coarse salt and put it in a spring brook. And he did, and he drank it, and the water was delicious. And he said, the problem's not the salt. The problem's the container. Make the container bigger. And Mark, that's exactly what you're talking about.
That's absolutely what it is. It's about widening the circle of compassion, widening the circle of empathy, so that it includes not only your immediate, your kin and your friends and your immediate community, but as Shannon was saying, the rest of the world. And when that happens, the self-pity level goes down, and the awareness level goes way up, because you realize that the nature of life, the part of the inherent nature of life, is suffering, and that we have to be able to hold that suffering with an awareness of our innate goodness in order not to be defeated by cruelty. And that's why you say that you can't push me around. But it's not that I'm in denial about human evil. It's that I am more aware of human goodness. And so I feel like that enlarges my container. And I think that's what all spiritual practice does. By widening the heart, you're widening the container and just putting the perspective of suffering in a more realistic light, because there is more love than there is cruelty in the world.
Chad?
I totally agree with Mark. And I think it's also not just compassion, but I think it's holding on to hope. And I think, you know, one of the great messages from Judaism of sort of coming out of bondage into joy, into promise. And one of the great messages of Christianity is sort of the grief and the pain of the cross on Friday, and then the joy of Sunday and new life and resurrection on the other side. And I think that in moments like the moment we are in right now in our country, where there is a dearth of hope, where there's a lot of pain, I think if we can sort of not forget and not over, not wipe away, but to look ahead at hope and to act, to bring that hope into action, to bring policy, to bring little acts that we can do individually to change this space.
Well, let's see if we can get another caller in before we have to take our break. Justin, you're on the line. Justin? Do we have you? No. No, sorry, we don't have him. Mark, One of your chapter titles is called Ought, O-U-G-H-T, does not exist in nature. Yet the concept of what we shouldn't and shouldn't do is filled with judgment.
It is filled with judgment, and it's a human creation. And the fact that when we look at cruelty in the world, we think that it ought not to be. But that's not nature talking. That's our ethical mind talking. The problem is that ethics shift from culture to culture. So what's okay in Saudi Arabia is certainly not okay here. So it's important to see that our oughts and our shoulds are relative. And they are arbitrary and not written in stone, so that we don't become judgmental toward the toward others who have different oughts than we do. It's not that we shouldn't behave in positive, you know, constructive, helpful ways. It's that we need to understand that our value system, our consensus reality, is different from people in other cultures, and that nature itself is not demanding that we respond in one way or other. We have the choice to respond, and so that's what that's about. It's about realizing that we are not the final arbiters of justice, that we need to be very, very careful about how we judge one another and how we mete out punishment against people who offend our sense of justice.
Well, I want to mention to you, Mark, to you, Chaz, we're going to say goodbye to both of you. I just want to share with both of you a quote I use often, and I love it. It's from Victor Hugo in Les Mis, and he says, "In darkness the pupil dilates as though searching for light, and in adversity the heart dilates as though searching for God." And what we're talking about now, whether you're religious or not, we're talking about a dilated heart. And that's what happens in adversity, and it is a dilated heart that's going to change the world. I want to thank you both so much for joining us, and especially both of you for the work you do. Mark Matusiak is the author of Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good. Mark Matusiak. Chaz Howard is a chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. Look up Resolution 13. It's really interesting. When we come back in 60 seconds, we're going to hear from Sharon Katz, Chris Newhart, and John Alston about how music comes in to change the lives of children and, of course, change the world. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Hi, I'm Michelle Martin. On my show, Tell Me More, we look behind the headlines to see what's really happening around the country and the world, from Zimbabwe to right here in Philadelphia. As the city suffered through an outbreak of violence, we heard from community activists like Kenny Gamble.
We are peacemakers. We are trying to make a model here in Philadelphia.
And we will bring you more stories that tell us more about who we are and where we live. Tell Me More, weekdays at 1 on WHYY, Philadelphia's NPR news station.
That was the children's chorus of Chester, and it was written by one of our guests. And I'll introduce him to you in a second. Well, in light of Friday's tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, it thrills me to open our next segment to the joys of caring for young children. I'm joined here in the studio by John Alston, who wrote that. He's the founder and director of the Chester Children's Chorus, which uses music to empower children in Chester. John, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by another old friend, Sharon Katz. She's a musician and activist from South Africa. She performs with the band Sharon Katz and the Peace Train. She and filmmaker Chris Newhart will travel to South Africa, her hometown, to interview the original members of the group, the Peace Train, and their path to peace and human rights. And by the way, Chris Newhart is here in the studio. Sharon, welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. Hi.
And Chris, hi. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing, Dan?
Sharon, let's start with you. Tell us about your work with children in South Africa.
Well, Dan, it was all about bringing the children together, listening to what they had to say and how they felt about the change that was going on in South Africa. This was 20 years ago. And bringing their voices together in song and to share hopes and dreams for a new and better, peaceful South Africa after the ending of apartheid.
So you grew up in South Africa during apartheid. Because your parents were European, you were relatively privileged and protected from the truth of apartheid. How old were you when you realized this terrible injustice was going on?
I would say I was about 10 years old at the time, or even younger than that, because we used to, you know, travel to Durban, which was my mom's hometown, and we'd travel through the countryside, and I would see that people were living in absolute dire poverty, and I wanted to know why. And when I was about 14 years old, I was privileged to meet the actors that were working with Ethel Fugard in a black township called New Brighton outside of Port Elizabeth, and I used to go secretly in hiding to visit my black friends in the township. So my awakening came very, very early, and I was breaking laws, but only because I just had that heart and that passion. I wanted to know and I wanted to understand, and I could never understand what was the reason for racism, and I still don't understand and I never will. You know, why? Children are not born to hate. I was born a white child. I was very sensitive as a child to the suffering of others, and as soon as I could understand a little bit more, my life was changed forever.
Let me turn to you, John. You have the same passion for children. Tell us where that was born, that passion. I mean, sure, you've got musical talent. I'm sure that's been in there your whole life.
Well, when I first started in Chester, I actually wasn't thinking about children at all. It was I was only thinking about making music, and I had this silly fantasy that we were going to be singing Bach cantatas in Chester, and I didn't know anything about social justice, and I wasn't thinking about poverty. But fortunately, pretty early on, I just fell in love with these children, and this marvelous transformation took place for me. And I tell the children all the time, these kids saved my life.
Hell, so.
And I imagine that without these children, I would have spent the rest of my life just dealing with my own issues and wanting to be a famous musician and not thinking about my responsibility to the rest of society and doing my part to make the world a better place. But these beautiful children just showed me that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to be working with them.
So I've got a question for both of you. I'll turn back to you, Sharon, first. We know that when we see this overwhelming suffering of others, something we all bear witness to, when we see it, people either go towards the suffering or go away and either pretend it's not there or, you know what we say, blame the victims. What was it that enabled you to go towards it and not away like everyone else in your environment was doing?
I think it was just my nature. I think my nature just made me love people, all people, and I wasn't the only one. You know, there was a lot of love, in spite of what we hear that, you know, all white people supported the Nazi-like regime of apartheid. That isn't true. There were a lot of people on all sides that were trying to end that injustice and felt that injustice very deeply. And I know that I was more sensitive, perhaps as a Jew, knowing about the Holocaust and my own family's history and oppression, that made me more sensitive. And also, I'm sure of it, like my friend here, you know, the gift of music that just transcends all boundaries, that just enabled me to communicate. But there was definitely my heart that led me on every single journey and still does.
Did your parents know what you were doing?
Absolutely no. Yeah. They didn't know a word of it. You know, as kids, we hide a lot from our parents anyway. And this was one of the things that I didn't tell them about. I knew they would worry. I knew they'd be afraid. And I'm really looking forward to meeting some of my friends when I go back to South Africa with Chris. We'll be interviewing John Carney. He's a great actor that worked with Ethel. And I used to go out to visit John and see him acting when I was really, really young. And I owe a lot to my black friends, because in those days, as today, they had the compassion to get through the struggle against the apartheid regime without coming out bitter, like Mandela, you know, to come out with that heart of openness and love and forgiveness is something that we can really all learn from.
Yeah, what a wonderful role model that was. John, I want to turn back to you. At what point did you realize that there was suffering out there and there was something you could do about it?
Oh, I think after the first few weeks working with the children, we just fell in love with each other. You know, the thing is that we are just wired to love children. I mean, that's what keeps humanity going. Any one of us would run into a burning building or jump into a lake, whether we could swim or not, to save some child that we don't know. That's just what we do. I think what's heartbreaking for us, for me and for Sharon and for all of us to do this kind of work is that most of the suffering that children experience in most of the world is absolutely unnecessary, and that humanity has the resources to take care of most of our children, and it's heartbreaking that we can't find the collective courage to love our children better, to take better care of our children, and to build the kinds of institutions that children need to flourish, because the resources are here, and we spend most of our time in investing in our own personal junk instead of thinking about our beautiful children.
Yeah, make the container bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you, Chris, about this documentary that you're making. Tell us about what you're doing and why.
Well, there's as you know, incredible story to the last 20 years of Sharon Katz's career. And not only as a musician, but as an activist. And the way that this has been brought forth has not been of like the mass appeal yet. You know, Sharon and Marilyn Cohen have been documenting and taking video over the years of everything and photos of all the incredible journeys they've experienced, both good and bad. And there needs to be an outlet for it. And after meeting with them, I realized that, you know, there's something that's hitting home with me about this. And while I don't have any kids, I can imagine what it's like being a parent, knowing that there may or may not be any hope. And the fact that people have spent, you know, much of their lives trying to instill hope, bring light, and bring good fortune to an area that suffered so terribly, it's just very inspiring. And it's very, you know, makes me want to be an activist. And what I'm good at doing is making films. And if that's how I can help for this cause, then that's what I'm going to do.
What's your dream about what'll happen with this film?
My dream with this film is really that it gets awareness out to everybody. I mean, I would love to get the film put out on Netflix, on DVD, in theaters, just so people have the chance to experience and witness what happened firsthand. I mean, in February, we're going there, and we're going to capture it in its raw state. And the ability to just show that to everybody so that everybody's aware. I mean, just I can speak from my generation, just that there's not a lot of awareness of what actually happened. I mean, we have the very textbook couple paragraphs about it, but being there, seeing visuals, I mean, all these movies over the years are so powerful, and this is a story that hasn't been told yet, you know, for the mass appeal.
Sharon, I want to talk about children and resilience. I mean, we've all seen this. Children are more resilient than we give them credit for. You must have seen some amazing things over there.
Well, absolutely, Dan. I mean, we were running, you know, we were operating the project, the Peace Train Project, during a civil war in South Africa, and we would literally count heads when children would come every Saturday to rehearse with us. And children came from all these separated areas, you know, geographic areas in South Africa that were imposed by the apartheid government. Black children had to live in black townships. Indian children lived in Indian townships. Everybody was separated by apartheid, and then having to find their way to come together to be with us, even to rehearse together before we mounted this huge 500 voice choir of all the different nations, different cultures coming together. And, I mean, children are so vulnerable, and yet, as you say, they are so incredibly resilient. They had such difficult lives, many of these children, from poverty, broken homes, not to mention, you know, the cultural imposition of apartheid. But somehow or other, the combination of them wanting to be together, of feeling accepted within our Peace Train community that we created, of singing together like you're doing in Chester, you know, dancing together and expressing themselves just gave them that opportunity to feel like somebody.
And I watch John nodding as though that's exactly your experience. Well, we are running out of time. I've been talking about Caring Endeavors with Sharon Katz, Chris Newhart, and John Alston, and I want to thank all of you. Early we heard from Chaplain Chaz Howard and author Mark Matuszek. Sharon, you've got a song for us. I can tell you've got a guitar right on your lap there. So I think we could all use some music, huh?
Music heals us all.
Yeah.
And the title of the song is "The Little We Have, We Share." That's really what it's all about. And thank you for having us on the show, Dan. Thank you very much. The title of our film, by the way, is it's called When Voices Meet. So... The little we have, we share. That's the way it must be. In the world everywhere, I carry you, you carry me. The little we have, we share. That's the way it must be. In the world everywhere, I carry you, you carry me. What of those that have fallen down? How can they get up again? Hearing their cries, don't say goodbye. Don't you know that you can be a friend? How can I know that I'll see you around while this war is gaining ground? Don't hesitate, it might be too late. That it's more than just fate. The little we have, we share. That's the way it must be. In the world everywhere, I carry you, you carry me. The little we have, we share. That's the way it must be. In the world everywhere, I carry you, you carry me.
Kanane, 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 Sisofika. Kanane, 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 Sisofika. Slowly but surely we can reach for the sky. Just give it away, we can give it a try. Don't say goodbye. Don't say goodbye.
Sharon, thank you so much. Boy, did we need to hear that. We'll hold hands. We'll do this together as we do everything together. Bless your heart for the work you do, and same with all three of you, John and Chris. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, and may this spread out to everyone, please. Thank Next you. Week, Voices will be preempted by a holiday special. Check out our website, please, whyy/voices for upcoming show topics. And while you're there, you can comment on today's show and download this or other Voices shows. There's also extras about today's show on our topic of caring. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I want to say a special thanks to Josh Rafeman. He finishes his intern with us. Josh, have a great year at school coming up in the new semester. Thank you for all your work with us. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please take care of yourself and others this week. Oh, and I also want to say extra thanks to Joyce Lieberman for her special help with all these microphones today. Take care, everybody.
Tell Me More is next on WHYY.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national